Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers. Available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. And yeah, you guessed it. It's me, Cameron. And of course, in studio with me is mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson. And today, we have a really fun interview, do we not, Mr. Filson?
Yeah, man, we got a good one. This is another one of those guys that we've been wanting to talk to for a long time.
Yeah.
And we almost had him on a couple years ago, and then he got busy, or we got busy. I don't even remember.
Both.
Both probably. And then we were like, well, we'll just do it in a couple months. And then a couple months turned into a couple years. But this is a guy who's very important to me. I remember in around 1997 or so, there was a documentary that was on television I saw on CNN or TBS. I don't remember what network. And it was called Fire from the Sky. Not Fire in the Sky, but Fire from the Sky. And he was talking about comets and asteroids and things hitting the Earth. And they had a lot of famous astronomers on there. And that's the first time I saw this gentleman. He was interviewed on that television program. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then years later, my friend Micah Hanks was like, man, I went and saw this guy give this speech. And he had a bunch of slides and interesting things. You need to talk to this guy. And of course, I'm talking about Randall Carlson. And yeah. So here we are, years in the making. But we finally had him on. And it's action-packed. It's pretty cool. I mean, this guy, if you're not familiar with his work, he's a catastrophist. I mean, he's a many things. He wears many hats. But he's talking about things that something extraterrestrial struck the Earth around 12,000 years ago. When I say extraterrestrial, I'm not talking about aliens. I'm talking about a foreign object, asteroid or a comet. And it totally disrupted the climate here on Earth, which led to the eradication of, like, I don't know, 5 million species of megafauna.
Everything on the over 100 pounds.
Yeah. So he knows all about that stuff. And we get into quite a bit. I mean, we're going to have him back on because we didn't get into everything.
We didn't even get the questions out we wanted to ask, because Randall just, he pontificated on much.
Yeah. He's a great guy, though.
I could literally sit and talk to him for weeks, man. I mean, I could listen to him tell me stuff. You brought it up. I had totally forgotten about that Fire from the Sky till you had mentioned it.
Yeah.
And I had remembered his name because you told me about it all the way back then. And I never watched it, but you had told me. The reason I didn't watch it is Kyle's been obsessed with, like, Carl Sagan and Cosmos since we were kids.
Yeah. One of my favorite shows.
Yeah. And so he would always tell me all this stuff. So I didn't remember Randall until I saw a video of him or whatnot talking to Joe Rogan years later.
Yep.
And Joe brought him up, and then he was on Rogan's podcast. And I'm like, that's the guy that you were talking about.
And
then, of course, he's, you know, him and Graham Hancock are best friends. And he actually was the man that took Graham around before Magicians of the Gods. And when he did all that. And now Graham's written that whole other book about America or whatever. and that's coming out in the next few months, I think in April. And it's all because of the stuff that Randall has helped Graham kind of find and gone through, and they've worked together. And from the way it sounds, Randall's going to be writing a book. It sounds like.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait. Coming. I mean, I remember when I first saw that documentary, what made me think about it or why it stood out was that was the first time that I was aware of all these foreign objects traveling near Earth all of the time. Like up to that point, I remember, oh yeah, the dinosaurs were eradicated, 65 million years ago by an asteroid. Nothing's ever hit the Earth since then. No.
As a kid,
we are literally in a shooting gallery, and it's happening all the time. It will happen again.
Yes.
And that's what's so terrifying is it's been a while since a big one's hit, so we're probably due.
And when it does, it will be a level of devastation that we can't even comprehend because of the size of our population on this planet now.
Yeah.
That if it strikes in the water, if it strikes anywhere near a populous area, all you have to do is just Google search Tunguska and then imagine that taking place over a city like Dallas or like LA or like, I mean, you pick any big city, imagine it's over any big city in the States, in London, in Australia,
yeah,
South America, anywhere. Imagine that. And hundreds upon thousands, if not millions of people will be killed.
Yeah. That's the ones that are close by. The problem is even if it hits in another country, it causes a global effect.
Yes.
So people be affected on the other side of the globe, even if it's nowhere near there,
no matter what.
So it's all terrifying stuff. Very interesting. Let's take a break. When we get back from the break, we're going to get into our conversation with Randall Carlson. Well, it's the beginning of a brand new year, and we want to talk to you today about our brand new sponsor, Robinhood. Do you want to be like J.P. Morgan, John Rockefeller, or maybe Charles Schwab? You want to throw your hat in the ring? You want to invest some of your dough in the stock market? Well, now's the time, and it couldn't be any easier. We're talking about a new investment app called Robinhood. Now, Robinhood lets you invest in the stock market for free, directly from your phone or desktop. Robinhood lets you buy and sell stocks, exchange traded funds, options, and cryptocurrencies all commission-free. It's simple and intuitive. It has a clear design with data that's presented in an easy-to-digest way. It's a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy. Now, I signed up with Robinhood on my iPhone, and it couldn't have been any easier. Really, I'm an idiot, which means if I can do it, then anyone can do it. Everything is straightforward. The app guides you step by step along the way, so setting up your account is simple. That's right. Just learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks and track favorite companies with personalized news feeds just for you. Now, what many of you listening don't know is that other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade. But Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. You can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Right now, Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. So what are you waiting for? You want to be the next Wolf of Wall Street? Then you got to sign up at expanded.robinhood.com. That's expanded.robinhood.com. All right, everybody, we got a special guest today. This is going to be a real treat. This is someone I've wanted to talk to, or we've wanted to talk to, for a very long time. This guy's a master builder, an architectural designer. He's a teacher, a geometrician, a geomythologist, a geological explorer, a Freemason. He's a man that wears many hats, and we're glad to have him on today. We have Randall Carlson. Randall, how are you doing?
Doing excellent. Yes, I am. Much better. A couple of weeks ago, I was down with the, we've had this cold, we had this spell of cold, damp weather here in Georgia. And I kept getting phone calls from customers, clients, friends, and stuff that were having floods in their basements because people here in Georgia don't know how to build basements. I grew up in Minnesota, and we knew how to build basements up there that didn't leak. Anyways, I spent an enormous amount of time out in the cold and the wet and the damp, and I came down with a bronchial infection that put me down for about a week. It was probably the roughest week I've had in at least a half a decade.
Ooh.
And then I lost my voice for a couple of days. And that, you know, for me, that's not a good deal. I had to postpone the interview I was going to do with Micah until I got my voice back. So, but it seems to be back 100% now, and I'm feeling 100%. So apparently I survived. I'm ready to move on.
Well, good. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're feeling better. And we're not going to take up too much of your time, so we're just going to get on into it. I remember years ago, this was like 1997 or so, I saw a documentary on TV, and it was called Fire from the Sky. And It was the first time that, along with reading of some books, that I was aware that we're literally kind of floating around in a shooting gallery, and the fact of all the impacts that have happened on Earth in the past that I was not aware of, and how it's a matter of time. And luckily we've gone this long in between the last major impact. And that show kind of led me to realize this fact. And then I started seeing some of your work. And I guess my first question to start out is, what led you into researching and studying all this stuff, this catastrophe things, this extraterrestrial thing that slammed into the Earth around 12,000 years ago, and that you've uncovered so much photographic proof of giant, where you can see where there was massive flash flooding. This was something that it was talked about all over the world with all the flood myths and things like that. And none of these things were taught to me in school. It was really eye-opening. What got you down that path?
That's an interesting question. And before I answer it, let me ask you, so you saw Fire from the Sky?
Years ago, yeah.
Okay. Do you remember that I was interviewed in that show?
Yeah, I think that's the first time I remember seeing you.
Okay, because I was thinking it was going to be interesting if you were recalling that show, but you didn't connect it actually. Because that was actually one of the first things I ever did through the media.
Yeah, I saw a couple of pretty famous astronomers on there, and then I think that's what led me into researching. I researched them, and that's how I came across your name years ago. And then I kind of just forgot about it for a while until my friend Micah saw you speak somewhere and is like, man, you got to check this guy out.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Yeah. Well, how I got into all of this was I have gone through it in my head because I've been asked that question many times. What was the decisive? Was there a decisive moment? Was there an epiphany? Was there an aha moment? There wasn't really. It was more just, tell you what, it was growing up in rural Minnesota, back in the 50s and 60s, and, becoming fascinated with, the stars, the landscapes, the weather. I was just, for whatever reason, I was always interested in stuff, even as a little kid. So I had, books on, the weather, how to identify the different types of clouds and how to use that to predict the weather. I had books on astronomy, how to identify the constellations and the planets and what was precession of the equinoxes and how the season changed. So it was a combination of having books that I would read and living in a place where, you'd walk outside at night and there was the brilliant sky. We lived on the shore of a lake, what had been a glacial lake. Minnesota and Wisconsin have thousands upon thousands of lakes, and those lakes are all essentially puddles of meltwater that are left over from the recession of the great ice sheets that, once covered half the state. So where I lived, where I grew up, was very much right on the margin of the great, what we called the Laurentide Ice Sheet, that was this massive ice complex that was centered over Hudson Bay. It was at least as large as the ice cap that now covers the South Pole. But where I lived was pretty much right where the fluctuating margin of this thing was. So it created a very kind of an interesting, almost magical landscape of, you know, many, many lakes and rolling hills and drumlins and things. So, of course, as a kid, I had no idea what the story was behind the landscape that I lived in. But nonetheless, I found it extremely fascinating. And so somewhere probably, you know, after I grew up and looked back kind of on my situation, I kind of began to realize, well, yeah, I'm sure that these interests that I've got really had their roots way back as being a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old boy living out there. And, you know, the constellations was something that I was very interested in. Also, I can remember on several occasions being outside, you know, brilliant sky, you know, you're out in the country, so there's not a lot of light pollution, and seeing brilliant meteorites, you know, which we just thought of back then called, shooting stars. Mm. I didn't connect them with comets or anything like that. It was just another fascinating aspect of the heavens. So then, you know, as I got older, I got interested in other things, things that a lot of teenage boys get interested in when they're about 15 or 16, sort of forgot about some of those other things until, about the time I got out of high school, about the time I turned 18, you know, I got swept up in all of the things that were going on in the late 60s, you know, so, I think that kind of brought me around to where I did a lot of camping. I would go out to places, remote places, like out in the prairies of western Minnesota and go camping. There was a place I used to go camping called Blue Earth. And the Pipestone River flowed through there. And the Pipestone River was an outcrop of this red claystone that the Plains Indians would quarry for their peace pipes. And it was a very magical place. And went out there camping several times. And at one time, this would have been the summer of 1969, a massive cyclonic storm came through. And it was an extremely impressive meteorological event. And I was told the next day by a ranger that came through the campground where we were at, said it was the largest storm that he thought it was the largest storm of the decade. So it was an amazing storm. And after that, I came away with this intense fascination for weather and, you know, things like tornadoes, because that one, on several cases, we, you know, living in where I grew up was right on the edge of the tornado belt. So tornadoes were very common. And I remember one year, I was probably about 14 at the time. It was a couple of tandem tornadoes that came through. I used to like to climb up on my roof and just sit up there and watch the sky go by and stuff. And so on this particular occasion, I was sitting on my roof and I was looking to the north, and this would have been about 3 to 4 miles north of where we lived. I was watching this cloud, this very strange looking cloud. And as I was watching it, this white funnel came out of the bottom of the cloud. And, it was very strange looking. I didn't at the time even identify it as a tornado. It just looked like a strange conical pointed cloud that was coming out of the main cloud.
Right.
And then a minute later or so, a second one came out behind the first one. Now the first one was kept getting longer and longer. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, that looks like a tornado, right? Well, then all of a sudden, the leading funnel cloud touched ground. And it's the instant it touched ground, it began to suck up stuff and it turned dark gray. Literally within a few seconds. And I got so, and then it looked like your traditional classic tornado, and I got so excited I almost fell off the roof. But I was up there and watched these things moving from west to east, roughly, because later I was able to see the path of destruction that came through. It was actually called the Fridley tornado, because there was a town, a little town in Minnesota called Fridley that essentially got wiped off the map by these tornadoes that came through. So that got me extremely interested in tornadoes. And another time we had been out, it was probably, I don't know, for the same summer, it might have been the next summer. This would have been 65 or 66, right in there. I worked on a neighbor's farm, and we had been out all day hauling in hay bales and bringing the hay bales in from the fields and stacking them up in the hay mow. And my buddy lived on the farm there. He was driving the tractor and we were pulling a trailer and we're coming back in from the fields. Now the fields were to the west of the farm and kind of in a lower area. The farm was up on a hill. So we're coming back, we're coming up on the ridge, and I look back and I see this very strange looking swirling cyclonic cloud going from south to north, and it kept turning. It was just obviously very, very revolving. And me and my friend, we stopped there and we watched it, and it just kept growing larger and larger and larger, and it was very white. Well, to our west, about a mile away, 2 miles away, they were putting in a road, and we're watching this cloud, and then all of a sudden, it just turned, it looked like one of these dust bowl storms. It just instantly turned into a gray wall, and we started running, and the wind hit us and literally blew us down. We ran, took refuge in the milk house, and for the next, I don't know, half hour to an hour, 90-mile-an-hour winds. You couldn't even see. We had the little window in the milk house looking out, and you couldn't see more than 6 or 10 feet because there was so much debris in the air. So we were in the middle. It wasn't a tornado. We called it up there. We called them cyclones because they were revolving storms that were bigger than tornadoes and smaller than hurricanes. Mm. But so I remember coming away from these things, you know, growing up in that environment, I got so interested in, I would say, the nonlinear things. Okay, you go along and it's normal day to day. It might be rainy one day, sunny the next day. But then every couple of years, you get one of these amazing events that just pushes it over the boundaries of your day-to-day experience. And it was those kind of things, I think, that got me really interested in looking at the bigger picture of, like, global change. You know, because once I got into... I got into the aftermath of the 60s. I kind of followed a path very much like a lot of people did. I began to, you know, look for answers to spiritual questions, and I began to study psychology, and, you know, I looked into, which led me into looking at people like Mircea Eliade, Carl Jung, Abraham Maslow, the mythologists that were linking, you know, the archetypal patterns of human consciousness with these ancient mythic archetypes. And so I got really fascinated with all of that, and it led me into studying mythology. And that was where you used the term geomythologist, which was not a term that existed back then. But nonetheless, my fascination with mythology led me into studying. I had studied already as a kid, was fascinated by mythology. So I had read a lot of Greek mythology and Norse mythology, particularly. You know, in Norse mythology, it's very apocalyptic. I don't know if you've ever read any of the Norse tales, such as Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great cosmic battles, the Midgard serpent wrapping around the world, you know, the Fenrir wolf. Then in Greek mythology, you had... you know, the story about Phaeton and his fall to Earth. You had the story of Deucalion and Pyrrha, who was the Greek version of Noah. So I had immersed myself in, as a reader, you know, when I was a kid, I immersed myself in these. And then as I got older, I branched out and I started reading a lot of Eastern mythology. And then I got very interested in the Vedas. And they were some of the oldest writings on Earth. And exploring into the Vedas, I discovered the ideas of the yugas and the kalpas, these great cycles of time that were, inaugurated in a new round of a new order of the world. And then at their conclusion, the world was destroyed. And then in the place, a new world would rise up. And that kind of resonated with the things I had read in Greek mythology about the four ages of the world, you know, the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. Because in the, in the yugas, you have ages of the world, and there's sort of a loose correspondence between those. And that led me into, it's this, you know, when you're when you're cursed with this obsessive need to understand things, it just, it leads you from one place to another. And so I kind of just, I went where I was led. And after going, spending 3 or 4 years, I actually became a student of a Brahmin priest. I became a student of a Himalayan Swami to try to learn more about the Eastern traditions. I became a student of a dervish, a Sufi dervish. All of this was in the early 70s. When I moved to Georgia, I started my building business. And because in building, you know, you use a lot of geometry, I kind of got very interested in geometry. We had been with this group in Minnesota called the Dhyana Mandram, which essentially meant meditation temple. And in the summer of 1971, we held a retreat up in the north woods of Minnesota. And me and my two brothers, younger brothers, were both involved in this. And as we growing up, our father was a carpenter and a house builder. So we had picked up and learned some carpentry skills growing up. Well, when we were going to do this retreat, the group that we were with had bought this acreage up in the woods of northern Minnesota, and they wanted to build some structures up there. So there was an architect in the group, and he designed two of the Buckminster Fuller domes, you know, the geodesic domes, what they are?
Yes, sir.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So we built a couple of these domes, and one of them was inspired by the geometry of an Islamic mosque, the dome on an Islamic mosque. And so me and my brothers were kind of tapped to be the crew leaders to build these things, because we were some of the only ones in this whole group that had any kind of building experience. So the one that was called the Bindu Dome, because the Bindu is like the point, the ultimate point. It's the singularity in Hindu cosmological conceptions. The Bindu is the singularity from which the whole universe emerges, right? So the dome was built with, it comes to a spire at the top, and when it comes to this very narrow point from which it is considered that metaphorically the dome is emanating from that point at the top of the spire. Anyways, that particular dome was featured in a national publication called Shelter that I think has been reissued perhaps a couple of times since then. So because of the fact that we were intimately involved in the construction of these domes, and that one of them was featured in this publication, I, of course, procured the publication. And in there, what it was getting into all of the various kinds of traditional and vernacular and sacred architecture from around the world, the way people built things and why they built things, and everything from a yurt up to a Gothic cathedral, right? And so in there, there was my first exposure to the idea of geometry as being a methodology for constructing or designing a sacred space. And there was several entries in there about how geometry was used by Islamic master temple builders, mosque builders, and how it was used by the cathedral builders, and how it was used by artists. And this was my first exposure to the principle of the golden section, or as it's sometimes called, the divine proportion. So this would have been 1973. And that I got really fascinated with geometry. And so I began to study everything I could find. And there wasn't that much back at that point in the 70s. But the stuff was starting to filter out. The works of Keith Critchlow I came upon, and he's a British architect and probably was one of the leading scholars of the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, writing and teaching and designing using principles of sacred geometry. So I sought him out and eventually did a number of workshops with him, learning some of the techniques. And then as I went along, I also was studying, because of my mythological studies, I became interested in things like Atlantis and other things like, so they've got, in the Greek stories, there's a story of a great flood just like there is in the Bible, right? So Mm-hmm. So I, you know, started looking into all of that. When I, going back to the Vedas and the idea of the yugas and the kalpas and all this, led me into this idea that there was, you know, because intrinsic to that whole conception of the universe is the idea that there are cycles of change and that these cycles, you know, are actually real in a geological sense. And so I read a number of books. Let's see, what would they have been? One by Otto Mook, who I think it came out in 1980. Another one called, let's see, what was it called? It was by Cedric Leonard was the author. And then, of course, there was Velikovsky, you know, the controversial Velikovsky. I read his Earth and Upheaval. And, you know, he sort of combined geology and mythology. He could probably be called the first geomythologist. And so it's like, for me, it was like, had interest in these separate sort of parallel strands of knowledge. And then at some point, they suddenly fused together, see? And so now we're you know, we've talked about the Younger Dryas, right? We know that the Younger Dryas was a period of very intense, rapid climate change that occurred around 12,900 years ago, right?
Right.
And it lasted about 12 or 1300 years. And then it was a return to full glacial cold after the late glacial climate had been ameliorating, right? Well, the numbers, see, it had become apparent to me through reading about and studying about the ancient cosmological systems that this number 12,960 kept coming up as half the cycle of the great year. The great year based upon the precession of the equinoxes, which is due to the axial tilt of the Earth. You probably are somewhat familiar with that concept, right? That the axis
yes,
of
sir.
The Earth swings around. It's about one, takes about 72 years for the axis of the Earth to move through 1 degree of arc. So then if you take that 1 degree, 72 years times 360, that's where you get the length of the full cycle, which is 25,920 years. Well, the Vedas are built upon repetitions and multiplications of those particular numbers. We call them the precessional numbers. So if you divide the full precessional cycle, 25,920 by four, you get 6,480 years. And what that is represents the four seasons of the great year. If you divide it by 12, you get the four, you get the 12, you could say months of the great year. And those months are essentially the average amount of time that the vernal equinox, which is moving because of this axial motion of the Earth, it's moving west to east, and on average it spends 2,160 years in each of the 12 signs of the zodiac. So if you multiply 2,160 years by 12, there you are back at the 25,920. So I got really interested in these particular numbers because I learned that those numbers represented not only cycles of time, patterns of temporal change, they were also the numbers that were employed over and over and over again in the ancient sacred architecture that were, and there are many examples of how these numbers were embedded into the sacred architecture. So for me, that was it was probably, I guess, in the 80s by the time I had begun to see that correlation. And that led me into the belief that, yes, there really was some very sophisticated knowledge once upon a time, far more sophisticated than has been acknowledged by conventional scholarship. So you had these numbers, and these numbers were showing up in the ratios and the proportions and the dimensions of sacred structures around the world. I'll give you an example. Angkor Wat is completely proportioned around the manifestation of these precessional numbers. Then I learned that the yugas are built upon the precessional numbers. And then you have the Sumerian king lists, which are some of the other oldest extant writings we have that go way back into 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. And those king lists are also built upon the processional numbers. So there seemed to be this very much interest in this in the ideas of cyclical change, and more frequently than not, those periodicities were determined by reference to this canon of these processional numbers, right? So it came about that, let's see, by 1996, I did a series of four or five lectures at Warren Wilson College in North America, in which I had identified, and this was right around the same time that Fingerprints of the Gods came out, or maybe it had come out, I think, in 95, and I had not yet read it, but I gave these lectures in 1996. So I was talking about the processional numbers, and by that time I had come to realize that these transitions from the glacial age to the interglacial age that we are in now was a very intense point of demarcation in planetary history. And based upon the study of the sacred canon of numerical cosmology, I had come up with the number 12,960 as being a half of a cycle, and it seemed to be indicated over and over again, just as Graham had indicated in his book, Fingerprints of the Gods. Now, what he did was he was back then thinking in terms of possibly a pole shift as being the trigger for a cataclysm.
Now, that's like something Charles Hapgood wrote about, correct, Randall?
But what's that now? Say that again.
Charles Hapgood wrote a book about the pole shifts, didn't he?
Yes, Charles Hapgood.
Okay,
Charles
okay.
Hapgood wrote Path of the Pole, and he also wrote the book on, what was it called? Was it Voyages of the Sea Kings?
Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings.
Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, right, yeah. And in 1979... I met a Masonic brother who was researching catastrophes, and he was the one who introduced me to Hapgood. And it was coincidental that right after I met this guy and he was doing his research into catastrophes, I went to a library sale, and right, it was like, you know, one of these kind of synchronicities, you know, that, mm-hmm. that happen to people who get into these kinds of things. I went to a library sale, and there's on the counter, like for a buck, there's Path of the Pole by Charles Hapgood. So like, oh, well, okay, I'm going to get it. And I did. And of course I devoured it. And he had a reference list at the end of, I don't know, 300 to 400 references. So I set about trying to locate all of those references. So I spent the next several years, hours of my spare time in the, Emory University Library here, the, Georgia Tech Library, the Georgia State Library. I made friends with the librarians so that they would get me, you know, papers and research articles, scientific papers and things that that they didn't have available through interlibrary loan. And then here in DeKalb County, we have this thing called the Fernbank Science Museum, and they have a science library that's set up for the public to use, but it's one of those you know, valuable things that's just so underused. So I was starting to go in there, made friends with the librarian there, and she got really interested in this research. This is in about the mid to late 80s now. So I went through the list and got and read just about every reference that Charles Hapgood had in Path of the Pole. But as you will recall, what happened in 1980 that was quite significant with respect to studies of global change, cataclysms, mass extinctions, and things. What happened in 1980? Do you recall?
1980.
This is a test now.
Oh, I'm going to fail this test. A lot of things happened in 1980.
I know.
I had my fifth birthday.
that was one of the things, the catastrophic things that happened.
That was very catastrophic.
I'm sure it was. You turned 10, huh?
Five. I turned five.
Oh, five.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was catastrophic to people in my life. That's what it was when I turned five.
Okay. You turned. Okay. Well, I'll, since you were only five, I'll cut you some slack. What happened in 1980 is Walter Alvarez and his team of geologists and paleontologists and two other teams all published scientific papers which were blaming the extinction of the dinosaurs on some type of cosmic impact.
So that's when this started making news.
Yes. So, and when that idea came out, see, that was another thing. As we go back, I was one of those boys, little guys in the 50s and early 60s that was absolutely obsessed with dinosaurs. I loved anything at all to do with dinosaurs. So I had this, what was it called? It was a ViewMaster set with
the discs.
Three reels about dinosaurs. And at the end of it, there's this big catastrophe. The sky is on fire and there's earthquakes and the dinosaurs are all destroyed, right? I got that it's the only thing I still have from my childhood is that set of ViewMasters. And I got it for my fifth birthday. And I just got obsessed with dinosaurs. And then there were some really cheesy dinosaur movies, 1 million BC. You ever seen that? The original 1 million BC?
Yeah, I think I've seen it.
Yeah, and it would be totally politically incorrect now because they used live animals in it, and those poor animals were probably horribly abused.
Oh, is that where they dressed up iguanas to look like Spinosauruses, yes, and things? Yeah.
Yes, and then they had a fight between an iguana and an alligator. And
yeah, like a Gila monster was fighting,
yeah,
one.
Like
I remember
that.
This now. Yeah. Plastic,
okay,
and super
then there
glue.
There was another really, really cheesy one called Lost Continent, which was probably early 50s, and it had animated dinosaurs, you know, the stop-motion dinosaurs, mm-hmm, rather than the lizards in costumes. But I just remember sitting in front of the TV just looking at those dinosaurs, you know. And here's the thing. If you go back and you start watching all of these dinosaur movies coming even up through the 60s, they all end with a catastrophe, right? The big volcano blows up. The lava comes down. There's earthquakes. You know, the dinosaurs fall into the earthquakes. And that, to me, that was always it. When I look back in retrospect, I always think that it's kind of interesting, you know, that, well, you know, because now we do know that the dinosaur age was terminated by probably a series of catastrophes, the way I interpret the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another factor that, you know, led me into this, because in 1980, when the work of Walter Alvarez was published, I found that just electrifying. Because to me, instantly, it was like, oh, well, yeah, that would certainly explain it. But, you know, the idea when it was introduced in 1980 was very controversial. It took at least a decade before the scientific community as a whole began to actually accept the idea.
Well, catastrophists, I'm sorry, Randall, but catastrophists,
go ahead. Yeah,
kind of got
the question.
They kind of got rubbed out. It was like, wasn't the idea of a catastrophists or catastrophe that caused like the end of the Ice Age and caused all this was an original idea. And then as more science took over, it became more along the lines of like we're talking about like over time. I forgot what the term they use, but it's like a long period, millions of years for this. So it kind of switched and the catastrophists were kind of laughed at. And then it ended up coming full circle. We're more like, no, it is a catastrophe that caused
it.
It
was episodic.
There you go.
Not linear.
Yes, exactly. The early geologists, most of the early geologists were catastrophists. And I have a whole couple of chapters I've written that's going to be in the book about those early catastrophists and how essentially that was the dominant view. And then between, oh, about the time of the American Civil War and the turn of the century, what you see is this shift. It was the Huttonian, I think it was James Hutton, a geologist, who first proposed the uniformitarian concept. And then that was followed up by Charles Lyell, Playfair. There was about three prominent gradualists who eventually came to dominate the emerging academic discipline of geology, so that by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, or, you know, the end of the 1800s, catastrophism has been largely discredited and replaced with uniformitarianism, which basically says that all changes in the past can be explained by reference to reference to changes that we see occurring essentially on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis now. See, and it's a very powerful diagnostic tool for understanding past changes. But the problem is, in my mind, is it became a dogma. And anything that seemed to go outside of this concept of one grain of sand and one drop of water at a time, extending over, you know, millions of years, can accomplish an enormous amount of work, which of course is true. But they largely, the geological community rejected the idea of sudden changes, of catastrophes, of cataclysms and things like that. For one thing, there was the fear that, you know, in some of the early catastrophists were also diluvialists who saw what they thought in some cases was evidence of gigantic floods in the landscape. And a lot of times they were actually right. But the problem is that when we look at the landscape and we look at the forces that can change the landscape, two of the greatest forces for landscape modification are great floods and big glaciers moving over the land. So what happened was the diluvialists kind of got discredited because once the ice age models came along, it was like, well, no, that evidence which you're seeing was actually created by the glaciers, not by giant floods. And that's why the old term for glacial till is drift. Now, glacial till is the material that is essentially ground up and pulverized by the glaciers moving over the land, right? And it shovels up material, and so it breaks up rock. And till, if you look at till, till, for example, will form moraines. Moraines are the piles of glacial till that form like a determinus or the snout of a glacier or along the sides of a glacier. When the glacier melts back, what you'll see is that there will be these arcuate mounds of glacial till, and then the floor that was beneath the glacier will be covered in, you know, sometimes tens or sometimes even hundreds of feet thick of this ground-up material called till. Well, the original term for till was drift. Now, drift more implies the action of water than glaciers, see? So it kind of shows just in the terminology how the concepts changed. So it changed from seeing all of this broken up material and thinking, okay, this was deposited by floods and by implication, you know, in the early 1800s. Well, if you're talking about a great flood, well, then obviously you're talking about the biblical flood, right? So there was a school of catastrophists that came that were actually some of the early geologists were theologians, and they placed their understanding of catastrophes within a biblical framework, right? So once the scientific method came along and the biblical model of Earth history, you know, that the world is only 5,000 or 6,000 years old and so on, and that became discredited, it was kind of a case of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You know, they just turned their back on any idea of catastrophism because that would suggest, you know, oh, we're going back to, you know, Noah's flood and the Bible, biblical literalism. So they were very scared of biblical literalism. So this is kind of where it's at as we're right at the dawn of the 20th century. So a quarter century later, when J. Harlan Bretz began to publish his papers.
I'm really glad you brought him up.
Yeah.
I love the end of his life. It's my favorite.
What do you love?
When he's proven right all these years later.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's my absolutely. Favorite thing.
Well, yes. And, you know, he fought against the establishment for decades before they finally accepted the reality of these gigantic floods. And I don't know if you've ever traveled over the floodlands of the Pacific Northwest, but I promise you, if you spend a week exploring those floodlands, you come away with the realization that, yeah, these floods were monstrous flows of water, almost inconceivably huge. So, yeah, there's an interesting story about one of the geologists by the name of James Gillooly, who, in Graham's book, Magicians of the Gods, he gives a great account of Carlin Bretz and his, you know, struggle to overcome the resistance of an overly conservative geological community. But, you know, he tells a story about how they were going to ostensibly give Bretz a hearing and give him a chance to make his case before a group of sort of establishment geologists. When it really, it was a setup. They were going to, what they did was they said, well, we'll get Bretz here. We'll invite him to Washington to this conference, and we'll discredit this idea of catastrophic floods once and for all. So Bretz came in, and this whole attack against Bretz was led by this geologist named James Galluli, right, who was an ardent uniformitarianist, ardent gradualist, right? In the group sitting there was another geologist who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey, was J.T. Pardee. J.T. Pardee had been studying the mountain valleys of western Montana, while J. Harlan Bretz had been studying the scabland erosion of eastern Washington. Well, at the conclusion of this at this conference, which was really an attempt to discredit Bretz, J.T. Pardee leans over to one of his colleagues and says, I know where Bretz's water came from, because he had concluded from his studies of these mountain valleys in western Montana that there had been a huge lake impounded in those valleys. And he was absolutely right that there was a huge, huge volume of water in those valleys. The question, though, became, what was the source of, in my mind, is what was the source of that water? Now, what you see is that in the 50s and 60s, the tide began to turn in Bretz's favor. It didn't happen all at once. But I believe it was in the 50s, I've forgotten the exact year, there was actually a group of geologists. Bretz had been challenging them for years, because a lot of his harshest critics had never actually been out and seen the evidence firsthand in the field. Mm. So he was challenging them to do this. And so there was this field trip. It was a week-long field trip attended by a whole group of geologists, including James Galluli, right? So they went out and they spent a week traveling over the floodlands, mostly, I guess, of eastern Washington. And after about a week, now this whole time, you know, James Galluli is observing, and you got to understand that when you're looking at these floodlands, there's a whole suite of features, right? You might have an extinct cataract, which is formed by a giant waterfall. It's no longer flowing. You might have huge boulders displaced, moved from their original position that have not been transported by glaciers. They're not glacial erratics because they don't have the very typical glacial striations on them, and also they're also outside the margins of where the ice sheet stood. So then you have what are called slack water sediments, because anytime you have a major flood and you have a big, highly augmented discharge down a main trunk valley, you're going to have back flooding up the tributary valleys, right? And the water will actually reverse the flow, the course of the tributary valleys, and it will generally flow back up the tributary valleys as to an elevation roughly equal to the depth of the floodwater in the main channel, right? Well, once the floodwater in the main channel drains off, then the tributary valleys can drain out, and they always leave behind a layer of sediment. Now, you can observe this on the small scale. You can observe it, you know, with a more normal type of flood that we might see every few years. But in this case, it left behind these enormous thick deposits that sometimes should be hundreds of feet thick. And so that was particularly the kind of thing that J.T. Pardee was looking at in western Montana. And he was also looking at the floors of these mountain valleys and discovering that they were these layers, these thick layers of these sediments. And then he noticed that up on the sides of a lot of the mountains was horizontal lines etched into the side of the mountains. Well, those were shorelines, right? So you could go on. There's a whole litany of these different kinds of features. Potholes is another one. that could be drilled right into bedrock, because if you have a large flow of water, it's moving very swiftly, it's very turbulent, and you get vorticular turbulence in that rapidly moving flood water. And if you have a flood that's sustained over a period of, say, days or even weeks, and you've got this vorticular turbulence, it will pick up sediment, and it'll be like a high pressure drill, and it can literally drill holes into bedrock, right? So what I'm talking about is that there's a whole suite of these features, right?
That he was trying to get them out to go look at themselves.
Yes. And you could say, you could take any one of these features in isolation and perhaps come up with some kind of a more gradualistic explanation. The problem becomes, though, when you take the whole suite of features. You know, it's like each one of these features sort of amplifies. The more features you add in, the harder it becomes to interpret by any other means than a gigantic flood,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, there are things called valley trains. Now, let's say you've got in a major flood channel, you've got a hill or a prominence that projects into the channel. Well, as this highly sediment-charged floodwater rushes by this prominence projecting out into the flood flow, what happens is that in the lee side or down current side of this projection, there will be a slowing of the current. And as a result of that, it drops sediment and builds what's called a valley train, which is this. And then after the flood subsides, you'll have this long, elongated, almost like a ridge or a hill that goes downstream off of this projection, right? When you look at it in cross section, like, for example, if there's a gravel pit or a road cut or a borrow pit or some way or a river that's cut into it, what you can actually see is that in the upcurrent side, the deposits, the sediments will be larger. Because think about this, the water's moving along. The faster it's moving, the more competent it is to pick up material and carry that material along, right? When the water starts slowing down, it begins to deposit the cargo of material it is carrying. Well, obviously, the first that gets deposited is going to be the largest, right? Then as the water continues to slow down, you'll have this graded sequence of material. So what you can see is that you can look at one of these valley trains, and they might be anywhere from 2 or 3 or 4 miles long and 300 or 400 or 500 feet thick. But you can look at the upstream end, and you'll see these boulders that might be 6 or 8 feet in diameter. You start going down current, downstream, and the boulder size diminishes. And eventually you're looking at boulders that are the size of basketballs, or then you keep going and you get to the far end of the thing, and the sediment is now cobble-sized rocks and then eventually gravel. And then if you follow the thing out to its very terminus, it might end in sand, you see. So you've got this graded sequence, and the only way you can explain that is through deposition by flowing water, see. Now, when you have one of these valley trains that, like I said, that might be 400 feet thick and 3 miles long, and it's got exactly the same kind of features you might see after a normal river or creek flood, but maybe 1,000 or 10,000 times bigger, you know, you're left with the inevitable conclusion that, yeah, this was created by some type of a hydrological event. So now you put all of these things together, and it's impossible to explain by any other means. So getting back to the story of the field trip with James Gillooly, there's a place right along this, just above the Snake River in southeastern Washington, where the Palouse River flows into the Snake. It's just north of the confluence of the Palouse and the Snake River. There is a cataract there where it's called Palouse Falls. The falls that's there now is compared to the huge alcove picture in your mind, if you can, Horseshoe Falls at Niagara, and turn the water off. And now imagine a cataract that's 4 times the height of Niagara and about 10 times the width, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
The only, and the river that's now flowing there is minuscule compared to the size of the cataract, right? It's a very awesome place. I took a group out there a couple of years ago, and it was one of our first stops. We spent a whole week exploring the floodlands, and this was one of our first stops. And I was telling the story about, as we're riding along, I'm telling the story about James Gillooly. And I said, this next stop that we're coming to is where James Gillooly finally had his epiphany. And so when we got there, you know, I took him over and I showed him, you know, that this was like the last day of this field trip. And James, it was said by other participants that the last couple of days of the field trip, he was being pretty strangely silent while he's trying to, you know, integrate what he had been seeing over, you know, traveling. And the culmination of this was their stop at the Palouse Falls. And he went over and he's looking at this little ribbon of water pouring over this giant cataract. And there's no way you could go, okay, this giant cataract was created by that little trickle of water coming over it.
Yeah.
So the story is that he was standing for a very long time looking into this huge bowl, you know, that's 400 feet deep and about 800 feet across, with this little trickle of the Palouse River flowing over it. And he walked back to the group and he said, "How could I have been so wrong?" Exact words. So, you know, it's like he fought tooth and nail against the idea, but in the end he gave in because he finally accepted the indisputable evidence, see? And it seems that we're kind of in a situation where we need more of that. And he served a purpose because, you know, what Carl Sagan used to say, he said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proofs. And that's been one of my guiding philosophies all along in this, that, you know, if you're going to come and say, well, yeah, there was this flood that was 1,000 times bigger than any known flood. Oh, really? Well, what's your evidence? Well, So Brett spent 25 years assembling the evidence, and it finally got to the point where it was indisputable. And that was the same way with the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, when Alvarez and his colleagues discovered the iridium layer in Gubbio, Italy, and knew that iridium was a signature of something cosmic. And, you know, that whole controversy over that, it took at least a decade. You know, most of the critics were coming along saying this: well, if there was a big impact on the scale that you're talking about, there should be a huge crater, and we don't see a huge crater. Therefore, there was no impact. Just like in the same way back in the 20s and the 30s, the critics said to Brett's, well, you're saying there's this big flood, but you can't provide a source for that flood. Therefore, there was no flood, right?
Right.
And we see the same thing happening with the idea of the Younger Dryas impact. You know, well, in every paper you read by the critics of the Younger Dryas, that's one of the first things they bring up. Well, if there was a big impact like you're talking about a mere 12 or 13,000 years ago, there should be a crater, right? So that's one of their first objections. There's a difference between the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis and the Cretaceous-Tertiary impact hypothesis. You know, the KT boundary, we're looking at 66 million years ago, and the extinction of the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. Obviously, long before humans were walking the Earth. If we're talking about an impact or a catastrophe 13,000 or 12,900 years ago, whatever, obviously, humans were around, and humans could have witnessed it, right?
Right, yeah.
And see, what's happened now is that the Younger Dryas scenario has a lot of political baggage with it that's making it even more, you know, more objectionable to the critics. Because, you see, right now, we're kind of in this, you know, we're in this mode of anthropogenic global change, which used to be called global warming, right? Then
right.
It became climate change. Now it's climate crisis, right? Well, here's the thing. Tied in with that are all sorts of other ideas. For example, humans are causing the sixth great mass extinction in Earth history, right? Now, as somebody who has studied the what are considered and called the five great mass extinctions, which is the Cretaceous Tertiary that exterminated dinosaurs, the Permian Triassic, the late Ordovician, the late Devonian, the Jurassic Triassic. If you study those in detail, what you come to understand is that they represent times when literally it was like hell on Earth. You can use the KT boundary, which in the five, the KT event stands right in the middle. Right now, you begin to look at what are some of the phenomena associated with the KT event. Well, global firestorms is one,
right?
Global seismic phenomena and volcanicity is the other. In fact, several geophysicists that have looked at it and the consequences of what you know, a 6-mile asteroid moving at hypervelocity speeds impacting the Earth would essentially cause every fault line on Earth to fail. So they're estimating that there could have been earthquakes on the scale of 11 on the Richter scale, which is almost inconceivable. It would have also caused large volcanic eruptions. And it, you know, the Siberian, not the Siberian, but the Deccan Traps in India date to the same time. And this was a massive, massive outflow of highly fluidized basalt that injected huge amounts of sulfuric acid into the atmosphere. Some of the atmospheric physicists that have looked at it have said, well, based on the amount of sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, there would have been rainfalls with a pH like battery acid, right? And then in the aftermath of all the dust and the soot from the fires and stuff that was injected into the atmosphere, it would block sunlight for months and plunge the Earth into total darkness, literally for months, if not several years, and bring on what has been called a cosmic winter, and perhaps even trigger an onset of an ice age. Okay, now you start putting all of this together, and you come up with a scenario that, like, wait a minute, months of darkness, global firestorms, massive volcanic eruptions, global acid rain, and it's like, wait a minute, we're supposed to be in the middle of an event that's comparable to that right now? And it's like, and the thought that comes into my mind is that, okay, if you're going to claim that we are now in the sixth great mass extinction, and yes, humans have caused extinctions of species, no doubt. I mean, you can probably name about 24 species that have gone extinct directly or indirectly because of the actions of humans. But the other idea that we're causing the extinction of, you know, thousands and thousands of species is totally hypothetical, based on computer models with a lot of very questionable assumptions. But clearly, you cannot compare what's going on now to the short-lived catastrophic events in Earth history, where, you know, if we were in the midst of something similar to the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary phenomena, we would now be extinct,
right?
We wouldn't be having this conversation. So when you start talking about this, okay, well, humans causing a mass extinction, well, yes, because look at the record. We've done it before, and this is constantly being said over and over again. Look at what we did. Look at what humans did to the megafauna at the end of the Ice Age. Look at what humans did, you know. So for decades,
that's the Blitzkrieg is what you're talking about there. People,
the Blitzkrieg,
yeah, which is
Paul Martin's term was the Blitzkrieg.
That's
bull crap. It would also be called the overkill hypothesis.
Yeah, I don't buy any of that.
I don't buy any of it either. Because okay, you can go in and look at the studies of the estimated human population during the last few millennia of the Ice Age. There were fewer humans than there were mammoths. But we supposedly were able, you know, Paleo-Indian hunters on foot using spears were able to exterminate somewhere around 10 million woolly mammoths, not wolf, but mammoths, so quickly that they weren't even able to procreate.
And not just then, mammoths, they're talking about also other large mammoths. Animals too.
Right. Over 100 species of large animal, which included the giant short-faced bear, glyptodonts, which were like large armadillos.
Wasn't there a giant lion?
Oh, yeah. There was the American Pleistocene lion.
Like a short-faced bear is not scary enough. There's a horse-sized lion running around, and all you got's a flint-tipped spear.
Yes. So right. And
you killed them all.
Killed them all. Killed them all. Then there was camelops, the giant camel. There was the Irish elk, which the large males had antler spans of up to 12 feet. And they stood up to 8 feet tall on the shoulder. I mean, can you imagine a creature like that, right? You had four species of mammoths. You had mastodons. So you had five species of proboscideans that went extinct.
But three were here in North America, correct? We had three.
North America had the woolly mammoth. It had the Columbian mammoth. And it had the Mammothus imperator, I believe, up in Alaska. And then it had mastodons. You know, mastodons roamed all across the southern unglaciated part of North America. So there was mastodons in Texas. There were mastodons in Georgia. Mastodons were browsers that lived generally in the forests, whereas mammoths were grazers that liked to eat grass. So they lived in the more open areas, in the grassy areas. But they all went extinct.
Randall, I don't even know what to say. You've taken all this time out of your evening to sit with us and to tell us, and we could go, we got to have you come back on, because I've got a list of stuff here that I didn't even get to this time. I've got so many things I want to talk to you about. Can you tell the people, if they're interested in the sacred geometry? I know your website offers classes. I believe you still sell DVDs and downloads and all that stuff of all your work still too, don't you?
Yeah.
Tell them where to find it.
Well, Sacred Geometry International is sort of focused on the geometry side of it. And then Brad Young's site, Geocosmic Rex, there's about 100 free YouTube clips going back like 15 years up to probably within the last year that people can download and watch. And if they want to donate a little to help keep doing it and getting this story out there, you know. But yeah, Geocosmic Rex is Brad Young's, and Brad Young has been my friend and colleague for about 22 years now, and he's helped me do all of this, these expeditions in this field research that I've been doing. He was, you know, was with me when we took Graham on his tour for researching Magicians of the Gods. And I will also mention, since you guys know Darren and Graham and the Grimerica boys, they're hosting this retreat coming up in May out in Southern Colorado. So we're going to do,
the contact at the cabin.
Say that again.
The contact at the cabin.
That's it. Yes. So, if anybody's interested in participating, you know, we're going to have, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to, the boys have, rented this lodge building, and there's camping sites, and we'll have classes, like doing multimedia presentations in the evenings. And then in the daytime, we're going to go out and we're going to explore in the field. We're probably going to do a lot of exploration, in Mesa Verde and Canyon of the Ancients. And it'll be, learning about archaeology and geology, the archaeology of the Chacoan culture and how their culture was integrated with the regional geology, which is some extraordinary stuff. The cabin, the lodge, is just north of Pagosa Springs, which was an ancient site of Native American sanctity because of the healing springs. So we would spend some time, you know, soaking up the healing waters of the springs. We may do a train ride on the old traditional steam train that runs from Durango up to Silverton, up along the Animas River. And there's no roads up there. It's only the railroad tracks. So we would get to see some extraordinary geology along the Animas River. You know, I'm a part-time percussionist, and so we're going to be doing some percussion stuff out there, which is a lot of food, great food, and I'm sure a lot of great you know, exchange. I'm sure that anybody who comes to the thing is going to be a really interesting person. So I think it's just going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be from May 17th for a week. I think the way they've got it set up, maybe there's going to be like maybe a 3 or 4 days, then there'll be another 3 or 4 days. But if I see what is the is it badcomet.com? I think Alan Neal has set up a website that will tell people about it.
To lead them to it. We'll put the links up in the show notes. We'll make sure everybody can get a hold of it and the whole thing. So that way nobody misses that, and we'll put it up to your stuff, because Kyle and I, we kept saying we were going to do the sacred geometry classes, and then we always finagled around and didn't get to them, but I think we're going to do them now. And then you talking about possibly going back and finishing your degree in geology makes me for sure feel bad, so I have to take your sacred geometry classes now. I feel like I could do nothing, so I got to get more involved.
I don't want to make you feel bad, Cam. I mean, but hey, if that's what it takes,
that's what it
takes.
That's right. I will do it. Randall, sir, thank you so very much. We'll have to have you back on. We got so much more to talk about. We could go on for days, but thank you for taking time and doing this, sir.
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it a whole lot.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Fascinating stuff. I could talk to Randall for days and days and days. Yeah. Probably would. If you would
and
like
probably
to,
will.
Yeah. Yeah, man. He's an incredible
guy. I see
guy.
Where you were going with that segue. I saw where you were going with that. If you'd like to talk to Randall for days and days, folks.
You can. There's an event coming up May 17th through May 27th of this year. The Grammarica guys are going to be having Randall there. And they're going to be in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be doing all types of things. They're going to be going like on expeditions to like Mesa Verde and other places around there. They're going to be doing a lot of talks. There's going to be other speakers there, I think, as well. And it's going to be a really cool time. I've been to Pagosa Springs probably 10 times. It's a great town.
It's not like you're just going in there and sitting and hanging out. This is like a retreat. Like you get to go and stay and like spend the day and spend the evenings hanging out. Like it's a get together that you could spend multiple days staying the nights and just hanging out, talking to Randall one-on-one if you want to.
Yes, they've booked this giant Elk Lake Lodge.
Yeah.
And there's going to be accommodation, you know, sleeping accommodations. And there's a lot of different packages. If you only want to go for like 3 days, you can do that.
And they're doing some podcasts there.
Oh, yeah.
They're doing all kinds of stuff. So if you're really interested and really into that kind of thing, and most of us are, you might want to look into this because it would be a blast.
I wish unfortunately, I can't go. It's right in the heart of baseball season, and we've got baseball. Travel baseball. So I'm not going to be able to go. Also, May 17th is a day before the twins' birthday, so we got birthday parties. It's just a bad time. But any other time, I would be there, because I love Pagosa Springs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a great town. Anyways, also, if you're interested in Randall Carlson's work, he offers a bunch of courses and classes where he actually teaches sacred geometry. And other things like that.
Wait, what does he teach?
Sacred geometry.
Oh.
What did I say? Sacred geometry.
I've never taken sacred geometry.
I've never taken either one. But
I will.
You can just search sacred geometry in international. And of course, I'll put links to it in the show notes.
I would like to take
I still
one
want
of those
to.
Classes.
We've been talking really about do. That for years. I would love to learn that
I
stuff.
Just want the big wooden compass that he's got like, he had one of them. They may sell them. I don't remember.
I know what you're talking about.
It's like a giant wooden compass that you get to draw big circles with and all that.
Yeah.
I would just like to do it kind of like as a party trick to show your friends. You're like, hey, check out. Let me show you these numbers real quick. And then you lay this out and they're like, oh, you're a genius.
Yeah, right. Like a lot of the ancient architecture and stuff was based on all these different symbolism and
which is what we're going to have him come back and talk more about that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's just, like I said, there's hours and hours and hours that we could sit and talk to.
Well, we've got that interview that you just listened to is only half of it. The other half is going to be going out on the Elite show this week. So if you want to hear the second half of that interview, you got to sign up for Elite. Just go to expandedperspectives.com, click on the Elite tab and sign up for $5. You'll get access to that, the second half of that interview, as well as all of the other episodes we've already done.
And I'm fixing to drop another episode there this week also. We're going to kick out two Elite shows this week.
Yeah, absolutely. So get over there, man.
And then I guess we need to do another OTC coming up. We need to go ahead and kick one of those out.
Yeah, people have been loving the OTCs.
We have some more stories about Kyle's little brother coming up because he's a troublemaker.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about...
Don't give it away.
You're just going to have to tune in. You're going to like this story.
We'll do a whole show about you just telling stories about all the times your little brother got in trouble.
I don't know if his boss would like to hear about that.
He doesn't get in trouble now.
No, he's a good boy for the most part.
He's a great human being right now. He is a first responder.
That's true. Yes, he is a
Which is crazy still to think of that.
He's making up for all the stuff he did as a kid.
I think I'd just take my chances on bleeding out trying to stop it myself.
Oh, man. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, please email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. And you can follow us on all forms of social media. For everybody out there, be careful. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
SpinQuest Social Casino. The presents are open, and you're over the in-laws. It's a perfect time to grab your phone and play SpinQuest.com with live dealer blackjack, craps, and a ton of slots. And here's a great deal for the holiday, a $30 coin pack for $10. And if you're hearing this ad, you can play right now on SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.